There must be that attention to these interlocking systems of hurt, of oppression, of injustice that reinforce one another, whether that is speciesism in an animal ethic context, where we make arbitrary distinctions about certain animals to eat, certain animals to have companionship with, and so on and so forth. Whether it is this elevation of culture over nature, doing an analysis of what a Buddhist ethic looks like today, if we're centering dukkha in this way and looking at causes and conditions of that dukkha in both humans and non-human animals today, then there needs to be an attention to these systems that ecofeminist scholars have looked at as the sources of oppression.
You're listening to Buddhist Studies Footnotes, and I'm Frances Garrett. Today I'm speaking with Colin Simmons, who's now teaching religious studies at the University of Alberta. His research focuses on how Tibetan Buddhist philosophy and contemplative practice are relevant to contemporary issues facing the more-than-human world. His doctoral thesis, titled Moral Phenomenology in a More-than-Human World, A New Approach to Buddhist Environmental Ethics, offered an interpretation of Buddhist ethics as a moral phenomenology and proposed a phenomenological approach to animal and environmental ethics from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective. Dr. Simmons is also interested in broader questions of animal ethics, environmental ethics, contemplative studies, yoga studies, and Buddhist studies. In this conversation, we explore many of these intersections. He talks about his work on deep ecology and on the feminist care ethics tradition, emphasizing the importance of relationship, community, and feeling. We also talk about expanding traditional Buddhist understandings of sentience to include non-human animals, plants, and maybe even AI.
Academically speaking, my work looks at how the Buddhist philosophical and contemplative tradition can be mobilized towards contemporary questions around the environment and non-human animals. This kind of comes from a personal interest. On top of being a scholar, I've practiced in different Buddhist traditions since I've been 17 or so. And along with this, one of the first moments in thinking through this Buddhist lens and relating to the world through a Buddhist lens was on the topic of eating animals and relating to the more than human world through the conceptual categories that Buddhism provides. And so originally, my work has always been concerned with looking at how Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist meditation can help us make better sense of our relationships with the environment and with animals. My doctorate was in cultural studies, and my dissertation focused on looking at the Tibetan Buddhist tradition and the contemplative frameworks found within and applying these frameworks to the environment in particular. I looked primarily at the framework of view, meditation, action, or Tagum Chösum in Tibetan, and looked at how if we plug in certain environmental views into this meditative framework, can we make people just be naturally more environmentally conscious in the day-to-day way they relate to the world?
You write about Buddhist environmental ethics in a really unique way, I found. And part of what you are doing is understanding the Buddhist tradition on its own terms, I think. You talk about the environmental ethics found in the land ethic tradition, and then the intrinsic valuation, you say, of abiotic phenomena or non-life-based phenomena in deep ecology. Mm-hmm. And you write about how those two traditions are often used to talk about Buddhist environmentalism, and yet there's a mismatch there. Could you start us off by describing what deep ecology and land ethics are?
Yeah.
And then how they make it hard for us to talk about Buddhist environmental ethics?
Yeah. So the land ethic and deep ecology are probably the two major strains of environmental thought that inform how most Western environmental ethicists approach questions of the environment today. The first of these chronologically was the land ethic, which goes back to this thinker Aldo Leopold in this book called A Sand County Almanac. And towards the end of this book, he puts forth what he calls a land ethic, which in the most concise terms is a thing is good if it preserves the integrity, the stability, and the beauty of a larger biotic community. And so Aldo Leopold comes at environmental ethics through this broad, holistic approach where the ecosystem is treated as the core baseline for ethical valuation rather than the individuals within the ecosystem. And so this kind of like Aldo Leopold was a famous hunter, for example. He had nothing against hunting. That was totally okay to do as long as it was a part of ecosystem health. Deep ecology comes later. Like in the middle of the 20th century, primarily the founders, Ernie Nace, though he did a lot of work with George Sessions to create what we know now as deep ecology. And deep ecology is most interested in the intrinsic valuation of individual phenomena, individual rocks, individual streams, individual birds, in the larger environmental community. In deep ecology, if something has intrinsic value, it has value outside of human use, and therefore it should be kind of left alone. This is taking humans out of nature, is what deep ecology calls for. And this contrasts shallow forms of ecology, which just look at conservation for the sake of humans. So like the national park system is a shallow ecology because it preserves these parks so that humans can go see beautiful waterfalls, which is fantastic, but it's not what Ernie Nace and George Sessions say is enough. When it comes to Buddhism, there's a bit of a disconnect between these two systems of environmental philosophy. Buddhism doesn't necessarily, in terms of its ethics, look at large wholes. It doesn't take this holistic approach to ethical behavior. There are many, many scholars in the world of green Buddhism or eco-Buddhism who have looked to interdependence or pratityasamutpada as the baseline for an environmental ethic. And I think it's certainly a part. But as a whole, Buddhism doesn't say, make sure that interdependent connections remain interdependent connections. Instead, Buddhism is really concerned with alleviating the dukkha or the stress, the dissatisfaction of individual sentient beings, of all sentient beings, but individuals within that all, which might perhaps lend to a deep ecological valuation. But the problem is deep ecology says that we need to intrinsically value rocks, intrinsically value water, and intrinsically value plants, which in traditional Buddhist cosmologies are not sentient. They can't feel pleasure, they can't feel pain, they can't experience dukkha. And so traditional Buddhist ethics kind of leave rocks and waters and trees outside of its ethical system. So deep ecology isn't a great match. But from Buddhist principles, I think we can begin to articulate an interesting approach to environmental ethics that centers individual sentient beings as the sole locus of concern. But if we're concerned with the well-being of individual sentient beings, we of course have to attend to the trees and the waters and the rocks and these broader whole systems, like broader ecological systems. And so I think value can be extended to rocks, waters, plants from a Buddhist ethical system, but only relative value, not absolute intrinsic value that's called for by either the land ethic or deep ecology. So it's kind of instrumental. It's almost kind of this shallow ecology where rocks and waters are instrumentalized, but they're not instrumentalized specifically for human beings. They're instrumentalized for the well-being of all sentient beings, humans, non-human animals, and so forth. I think a Buddhist approach to environmental ethics instrumentalizes rocks, waters, trees, other plant life, to the end of supporting non-human sentient beings and human sentient beings alike.
I want to just go back to deep ecology briefly because Arne Naess, of course, used Buddhism a lot, and many other people do conflate Buddhist principles with deep ecology. Can you describe why a little bit more in detail why that's how they were using Buddhism and then why you think that's not appropriate or as helpful as other approaches?
Yeah, when it comes to Ernie Nace using Buddhist sources for informing his deep ecological thought, there are two ways that he does so. The first is through this appeal to interdependent connections. And the second is to this appeal of what he calls self-realization, which is kind of the end goal of deep ecology. And to a certain extent, I think if we're just building up an environmental ethic from Buddhist resources, those two things do exist. I think a Buddhist environmental ethic does absolutely attend to the interdependent connections amongst things. It's the background that informs how we act in the world. Likewise, I think a Buddhist environmental ethic, depending on how we understand Buddhist ethics, might lend to this position where the individual just naturally acts in accordance with their ability to see interdependence clearly or to see causal connections clearly. There's this priming that happens in a lot of Buddhist ethics where it's not so much about specific rules. It's not so much about this kind of calculus that we make about what is good or bad, but it's really about expressing our own realization of interdependence, our own compassion, our own development in this Buddhist system. There's this natural action, which is what Arnie Nace eventually says deep ecology should get to, where you don't have to think about whether or not I should chop a tree down. You just naturally know I probably shouldn't chop that tree down. And this idea of getting into this kind of naturalized approach to the more than human world, I think is certainly shared by deep ecology and by maybe a Buddhist approach to environmental ethics. I think really the main difference or the main tension that I see in just equating deep ecology with Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist environmental ethics is this idea of intrinsic valuation, which at least a Mahayana Buddhist approach to environmental ethics would have to reject because of its emphasis on emptiness. And emptiness, of course, is the emptiness of specifically intrinsic existence. So there can't be intrinsic valuation if there is an emptiness of intrinsic existence in the first place.
Right. Thank you. That's helpful. I think you were there starting to touch on moral phenomenology.
Yeah.
And it seems that that's really at the root of your understanding of Buddhist environmental ethics. And I wonder, before we get to that, if you could explain to us what moral phenomenology is.
So when scholars of Buddhist ethics were trying to formulate what are Buddhist ethics, at least in the Western context, they originally tried to compare Buddhist ethics with certain forms of Western ethics, whether that's Aristotelian virtue ethics, whether that's a consequentialist ethic, or even Kantian deontological ethics. And there's different scholars who have made arguments to each of these ends. And a lot of this work is really valuable and really good. But I think it misses this certain component of Buddhist ethics that is this felt, spontaneous approach to ethics. So when I talk about moral phenomenology, I follow the work primarily of Jay Garfield, who's written about moral phenomenology in kind of a number of places, in a couple of articles, in a couple of books. And for Jay Garfield, Buddhists were not necessarily concerned with rules as they mediate our experience with the world. Rather, a lot of Buddhist ethicists are concerned with our experience of the world. Experiencing the world in a particular way allows us to act in a particular way. So moral phenomenology, it's an experiential or perceptual approach to ethics that's built from this notion that our intentional states, like how we intend to act in the world, our affective responses or emotional reactions to the world, and our actions themselves emerge from this direct perceptual experience of the world. So in essence, how we think about the world just directly in the present moment informs how we react to the world. Maybe I always use when I teach Buddhist concepts in classroom settings, for whatever reason, I think it's because I commute often between cities by car, I always use the example of someone cutting you off in traffic, where if you are understanding that person as you know, a suffering person who's maybe on their way to a job and they're late for work or what have you, if you see them in that way and they cut you off, you're not going to respond just with anger. Whereas if you see them in terms of just another individual and you're up in your own thoughts and your own dukkha, then you might, you know, scream at them or flip them off or do like react in a negative way. So it's really the seeingness of our relatedness to the world that informs how we react to the world. And I think this forms the basis of Buddhist ethics in a unique way. This experiential idea of, for example, seeing ourselves as interdependently originated with all other phenomena informs how we act within the world. If things were discrete, independent things, then we would act in a different way. And many of us do see the world that way. And Buddhism tries to encourage us to see it as more interdependent. And so it's that seeingness that becomes the most important part of an ethical approach to the world in Buddhist contexts. It's our lived direct experience that involves perception, that involves feelingness and embodiedness, and I think involves our direct conceptual mediation, these ideas that we have that we kind of apply to the world as it happens, that then informs our ethics. And so refining our ability to see the world in a particular way, in maybe a more realistic way, according to Buddhism, would therefore be how we develop ethically, rather than developing better rules or even particular virtues.
Yeah, thank you. So, right, another ethical system might give us a list of rules and advise us to follow those regardless of what of other aspects of our experience, or encourage us to develop certain virtues that might then lead to certain behaviors. But you're saying that through a certain kind of Buddhist training, we then also have a transformation of what we perceive the world to be, such that, for example, ourselves, if we understand ourselves as interdependent in this kind of deep way with all other things, then when we see damage to the environment, we see damage to ourselves because we understand ourselves to be, I mean, the same in a sense, or necessarily related.
Yeah, exactly. And I think then that gets flipped where every single action that we take affects everyone. And if you really see that directly, then you're going to be a lot more careful with your actions. Nagarjuna in the text, The Ratnavali, he has this line, Shunyata Karunagarbham, which is like, emptiness is the womb of compassion, or kind of rephrased, if you directly see emptiness or you directly perceive interdependence, then you'll just naturally be compassionate. And I think that's at the heart of this approach to a Buddhist environmental ethic or Buddhist ethics more broadly, where if you really see that everything's interconnected, everything is dependently originated, everything's causally related, then you're just going to naturally be much more careful with your actions, whether that's ecologically speaking or socially speaking or what have you.
I think this is then where you come into the care ethics tradition and ecofeminist approaches. Can you describe for us what the care ethics tradition is?
Yeah, so the care ethical tradition is coming from this feminist ethical tradition that's rejecting this purely rational approach to ethics that we might find in Kantian deontological ethics or utilitarianism or what have you, where certain scholars, especially I think it goes back to Carol Gilligan primarily, really tried to articulate the importance of relationship, of community, and of feeling in terms of our ethics. If we actually look at how our ethical lives exist, it's often through relationship. It's often through community. We're not just these isolated little creatures that use rules in this cold way to go about our lives. When this care ethical tradition gets applied to environmental and animal ethics, this notion of relationship becomes really important. I'm thinking of, for example, the work of Laurie Gruen, who has this idea of entangled empathy, where our relatedness to non-human animals, whether that's companion animals like our dogs or cats, or domesticated farm animals like pigs, or even wild animals or free-roaming animals like kind of crows or deer or what have you, really being in relationship with these animals can form the basis of an entire ethical system. It can really inform how we act within the world if we're really carefully attuned to our relationships and with feeling alongside these non-human animals. And I think Buddhism encourages a very similar thing. This idea of empathy is quite close to this notion of karuna or compassion, where we're encouraged in Buddhist contexts to feel alongside other sentient beings. And this feeling alongside eventually leads to care, to helping non-human sentient beings and human sentient beings to alleviate their dukkha. And so I see these traditions as really paralleling each other. If we're looking at moral phenomenology as a kind of care ethic that Carol Gilligan forwards, then the kinds of Buddhist environmental ethics that we are able to articulate are going to look like these ecofeminist care ethics as well.
In some of your writing, you talk about the word compassion in English not really covering the semantic range of this Buddhist term karuna, and you suggest that care is a better translation term because compassion, sometimes we might think of it as just a cognitive sentiment or, you know, a feeling in the mind, whereas you're wanting to emphasize that it's an affective attitude toward the environment that propels you to action. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And I really have to give credit to Jay Garfield for this interpretation of karuna as well. I really like his work on ethics, obviously. but I think when it comes to especially practical ethics, of not necessarily just thinking about our ethical worlds, but really being in our ethical worlds, this idea of care, I think, gets at what not only is, but what should be more closely than compassion. When we see a hurt animal, we want to go help it. Or if we see our kind of family member or our loved ones sad, we want to go help them. There's not just this detached feeling alongside. There's this active want to alleviate that distress or that suffering or that dukkha. Care encapsulates better this understanding of karuna than merely feeling alongside, which is the root of the word compassion.
So that brings me then also to ask you to say a bit more about suffering or dukkha and how that mirrors this care ethics centering of oppression, systems of oppression and suffering, which makes this an intersectional ethic of care in a way that some other approaches to Buddhist ethics sort of don't take into account.
Yeah. Especially when it comes to ecofeminist care ethics, there is, as you suggest, this attention to systems that create oppression that have lived effects in the everyday experience of human beings. Likewise, while it's not necessarily in the Buddhist tradition itself, attending to these systemic structures of patriarchy or heterosexism or racism, by centering dukkha in the way that the Buddhist tradition does, there is this constant search for alleviating the causes of that dukkha, the interdependent causes and conditions of that dukkha. And if we're doing an analysis of what a Buddhist ethic looks like today, there must be that attention to these interlocking systems of hurt, of oppression, of injustice that reinforce one another, whether that is speciesism in an animal ethic context where we make arbitrary distinctions about certain animals to eat, certain animals to have companionship with, and so on and so forth. This idea that Melanie Joy has called carnism, whether it is this elevation of culture over nature, which a lot of ecofeminist scholars have said, well, this just mirrors rationality and feeling or man and woman in a way that all of these kind of things reinforce one another, this dichotomization of things, this explicit privileging of one over the other, which is problematic. And it creates dukkha, not only in the human, but in non-human animals. If we're centering dukkha in this way and looking at causes and conditions of that dukkha in both humans and non-human animals today, then there needs to be an attention to these systems that ecofeminist scholars have looked at as the sources of oppression. So it goes beyond mere let's preserve this stream for its own sake. And it goes kind of to these broader pictures of why are we exploiting the environment in the first place? Like, what are the things that are compelling people to over-extract, to clear-cut forests, to just pollute, and so forth? We need to look at these broader ideological systems that create the context for this exploitation in the first place. certainly in the work of, for example, Joanna Macy and Stephanie Kaza, there are these connections being made, and they're really excellent pioneers of this whole genre of eco-Buddhist scholarship.
To go back to something you referred to earlier, you talked about sentient beings, and you've written an interesting article about the definition of sentient being and expanding our thinking on what it is to be a sentient being. And I wonder if you could summarize for us some of the traditional approaches to what, or let's say Tibetan Buddhist approaches to semchen, what a sentient being is, and then how you're wanting to or thinking that this could be expanded.
The word for sentient being in the Tibetan tradition is, as you said, semchen, which literally translates to mind possessor, or that which has a mind. At that basic level, we can understand ourselves and other human beings as having a mind. We can understand non-human animals as having a mind because they exhibit similar behavioral properties as we do. What becomes difficult is then looking at plants or looking at bacteria or looking at fungi and making these same claims. And so this piece I wrote, Expanding Sentience, in the Canadian Journal of Buddhist Studies, it really took up this question of AI sentience, actually. This Google engineer named Blake Lemoine claimed that his language model was sentient. And in fact, it was doing Buddhist koans and talking about how it meditates every day. And I was like, what is happening here? And is this AI sentient? And so I tried to look at what sentience is. In the Tibetan Buddhist context, sentient beings are sixfold. There's this sixfold hierarchy of beings where there's gods, jealous gods, human beings, animals, hungry ghosts, and hell beings. And so plants are left out of this equation. AI is left out of this equation. Bacteria is left out of this kind of cosmology. But there are beginning to emerge certain studies that suggest plant intelligence and bacteria intelligence or slime mold intelligence that complicate this traditional Buddhist cosmology. And I think a lot of this evidence is compelling enough that we need to expand the category of sentience. Or I would suggest that Buddhists rethink the categories of sentience within their system. So some of these studies are really quite interesting. Monica Gagliano in 2016, her and like a team of scholars looked at how pea plants were able to learn to respond to neutral cues to navigate a Y-shaped container and to locate and capture light outside of their normal phototropic capacity. So they were doing things outside of just mere instinct. They were having this internal reflection. And this suggests to a certain extent this internal experience. Anthony Trebovas in 2003 wrote that plant intelligence has been overlooked not because of a lack of evidence, but because of their sessile lifestyle, because it's really hard to relate to what it means to be a plant. But he showed that plants can map 3D spatial environments. They can communicate with other plants. They can retrieve memories. They can make intentions and choices. So there is this internal experience to plants that's not unlike animal experience. This being the case, to have a mind is to experience dukkha. All of the beings in the six realms, whether they're gods or hell beings or humans or animals, experience dukkha. And so dukkha and the ability to experience dukkha is often how mind is understood. There are other definitions as well, but that's at least the one that I operationalize here. And if plants are making all of these decisions about how to map spatial environments, how to share information with other plants, they're showing preference. They're showing this preference towards things that help them flourish and away from things that cause them harm. And so this suggests to a certain extent that plants experience dukkha. And there's really similar experiments that have been done on bacteria and on slime molds, where bacteria show that they consume latent information in the environment and make cognizant decisions between things that might cause them harm and things that don't. And similarly, these slime molds or these single cellular organisms have shown preference for non-optimal food sources depending on the context. So essentially, a slime mold will get bored with this optimal food source and just want to eat this other food source, just not for any biologically beneficial reason, but because it wants to. And so there's all of these interesting studies that, of course, are not definitive, but at least suggests that this category of sentience should maybe be expanded beyond kind of the Buddhist understanding of human, animal, God, hell being, and so forth.
That's so fascinating. I love that research so much, and I really love that article of yours. I think you do cite one contemporary Buddhist thinker who has developed some traditions of practice around honoring the care of bacteria and other small non-animal creatures. And so it is kind of coming into a Buddhist tradition in certain parts of the world. But of course, Buddhist traditions around the world have transformed themselves uncountable times in reaction to different cultures and different modes of knowledge, different traditions of science and other kinds of cultural traditions, if you take science as one cultural tradition. And so there's nothing unusual about a time now where Buddhists might be able to adopt the kinds of things that you're talking about, a new understanding of what plants are, what bacteria are, that would allow them to exist in the world of the six realms or in the world of suffering, mm-hmm. and therefore be sentient.
Yeah, I look at as a way to make sense of this updated understanding of sentience, I try to look for precedents within the Buddhist tradition of this happening. And there's a very mm-hmm. kind of famous example now of the Dalai Lama looking through a telescope at the moon and seeing shadows on the moon and realizing that mm-hmm. the Abhidharma cosmology, this traditional Buddhist cosmology of the moon being a light source, actually is wrong. And he eventually makes this claim that Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, this text on the Abhidharma that most Buddhist monks in Tibet will study, didn't really appeal much to him because he had already learned about modern astronomy. And in fact, he claims that we need to throw away a lot of Abhidharma cosmology because it's not accurate. And he uses Buddhist logic to do so. So I think there is precedence for this kind of expansion. This teacher you mentioned earlier, his name's Lama Yongdu Choki Gyaltsen, or he's Mark Weber is his Western name. He's this Western Lama coming from this kind of interesting hybrid tradition of Theravada and Tibetan Buddhism. But he's also a microbiologist. And so he's really studied these tiny, tiny diatoms or these tiny, tiny microorganisms. And he's told me, like, they're having a really hard time, these diatoms, these two-celled organisms. And I remember thinking, this is not classical Buddhist understandings of things. Like, he's really feeling compassion for this tiny single-celled organism or two-celled organism. And it really was fascinating to me. And so he's written about this, as you suggest, about in our loving kindness meditations, for example, not only extending loving kindness to humans across the world, to non-human animals, but also to amoebas, to bacteria, to moss, to lichen, to plants, to grass, and so forth, in this, I think, novel way, but in a way that somewhat accords with both his understanding of contemporary science and Buddhist understandings of sentience.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And so what did you come to conclude about AI?
I think as it stands now, it's difficult to claim that AI is sentient, according to Buddhist understandings. Like another clear definition of what a sentient being is involves a certain kind of embodiment and perception and feeling that just AI doesn't have as software. At least yet, we'll see. But also, I think a lot of the critiques of this Lambda model have shown that it's just regurgitating information according to specific inputs that it thinks the person will want to hear, which makes it really difficult for ascertaining whether or not there actually is an inner life in the first place, or if it's just, as we used to think of animals, just instinctually spitting out information according to context. So who knows? Like, I think as it stands right now, like ChatGPT, Lambda, these AI generation models, I don't think meet the degree of sentience, but they could. They could.
That's great. Could you talk a little bit about the work you've done on vegetarianism?
Yeah, vegetarianism has been my most recent major project, and looking at not only historical precedents for vegetarianism, but taking this philosophical approach to animal ethics from a Buddhist position in a way that I kind of did similarly with Buddhist environmental ethics. I was really inspired by the work of Andrew Lindsay, who's this reverend and PhD in theology. And he has this book called Animal Theology, where he tries to look from Christian sources how we might construct an animal ethic. And it's really creative in terms of its application of Christian ideas, but I think it's quite a powerful text. And I remember reading it and thinking, this has never been done for Buddhism. There's never been this full mobilization of the Buddhist tradition towards constructing an animal ethic. There are certainly historical traditions of vegetarianism from China to Japan to Tibet to Vietnam, but there hasn't been this systematic articulation of how Buddhists should or can approach the question of non-human animal ethics. So this is something I've really started to take up. And I think when it comes down to, if you're going to put it in a single line, in a Mahayana context, I don't think you can vow to liberate all sentient beings and pay for others to kill them so you can eat them in a contemporary context. And so I try to tease out what are the resources for supporting this claim, which can be found both in the scriptural tradition and in the commentarial tradition and in just the lives of Buddhist practitioners themselves. And there's a lot of richness there, but I think that's foundationally the claim that Mahayana Buddhism leads us to.
And how do you deal in your work with the fact that despite there being some sources that support vegetarianism or animal ethics, Buddhists primarily are not vegetarian? I'm sure you get asked that a lot.
Yeah, and it's a funny thing because in, I guess, like the popular imagination, it's often a shock to hear that Buddhists are not vegetarian. Whenever I tell that to students in my undergraduate classes, it kind of takes a moment to register because there's that idea of the loving monk treating everything with kindness and compassion. But that doesn't necessarily square with our understanding of meat eating. Jeffrey Barstow is one of my doctoral supervisors, and he's done some really great work on especially Tibetan Buddhist approaches to vegetarianism or non-vegetarianism. And he really outlines this idea of threefold purity that is found in the Pali Suttas. And this idea of the threefold purity is the Buddha said that you could eat meat if it was pure in three ways. If you didn't see that it was killed specifically for you, if you didn't hear that it was killed specifically for you, or if you didn't suspect that it was killed specifically for you. And so this rule was forwarded in the context of monks and nuns going for alms for their daily food. So they would go to a lay household, they would get food, and if that meat that was placed in their bowl wasn't killed specifically for them, they would eat it. And so this sets the grounds for this Buddhist allowance of meat eating. In Mahayana context, especially in the Lankavatara Sutra and the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, there's this explicit rejection of that earlier rule. Like the Buddha just recants and he says, yeah, I said that at the time to make sure that people like could eventually become vegetarian. Like I made this kind of middle way rule of vegetarianism where not all meat is good, but some meat is okay. But now I am saying if you were a follower of mine, if you're a Mahayana Buddhist practitioner, you cannot eat meat. And so there's this explicit tension within the tradition itself that creates this huge ambiguity that requires individual Buddhists operating in the Mahayana tradition to square these two things. And it allows for some variability in how you approach meat eating. I think when it comes down to how meat is produced today, there's many arguments that lean towards a vegetarian position, where if you're going to buy meat at the supermarket, perhaps it's not killed specifically for you, but it's creating the demand for that killing. And so there's some nuances to the application of the rule of threefold purity today that even if we look at historical Tibetan sources, they were dealing with this ambiguity in very similar ways. The yogi Shabkar Tsogdruk Rongdrol, he's a really fascinating figure, and he's one of the major proponents for vegetarianism in the Tibetan tradition. And he looked at how these monastic institutions would create this demand for meat, and butcher shops would be set up directly outside the monastery in Tibetan context because there was a demand for meat. And so he made the argument that if all of you monks and nuns just stopped eating meat, then that butcher would not kill those animals. So he makes a very kind of market-based argument saying, if we are going to like make sure that our meat is pure, this is not pure meat. So he leans in the direction of the Mahayana sutras and he kind of rejects this idea of pure meat, not on the grounds that it cannot exist, but that the meat that those Tibetan monks and nuns were eating was not pure in the three ways. And so I think applied to our supermarket kind of situation today, that argument still persists. If Buddhists are going to a supermarket and buying meat, they're creating the demand for meat, which is creating the demand for animals to be killed.
I'm curious to know what you are teaching nowadays and which of these ideas that we've discussed, so many interesting things that I feel like students would just be loving, mm-hmm. just very, you know, such a set of interesting and relevant to today's time set of ideas that you're working with. What do you find students most inspired by, excited by in the classroom today?
Yeah, this semester I'm teaching two courses that touch upon these specific ideas. One is a course on Buddhism. So we, of course, talk about the environment and animals in Buddhism. And another is religion, animals, and nature. And in both of these courses, students are really, really committed to living in an environmentally friendly way. And so when we talk about these ideas of interdependence, when we talk about these ideas of compassion and of seeing the world in a particular way, they really are enraptured by these ideas because I think they're imminently practical. This idea that we should see the world as interdependent and act in positive ecological ways, I think is something that's somewhat inspirational.
In your teaching, do you do any experiential learning type assignments that allow students to do something other than research about topics, but to kind of transform their lives in certain ways as part of the class?
What I do encourage is this perceptual approach to the environment and this idea that like in Kingston, where I'm speaking from, there's Lake Ontario and it's very, very accessible for all students. It's right by the campus. And I say, go out with a friend and just sit by the water and be with the water. Just be in the environment, not doing anything productive, not trying to think of anything, but just feel alongside it what it feels like to be in the natural world. Because as I teach them in class, just this beingness in the world can affect these phenomenological transformations or these experiential transformations that can have really profound ethical shifts on people in a similar way that meditation can in like a classical Buddhist sense.
That's so interesting. I'm glad I asked that because I had this plan, and maybe I'll still do it someday, of teaching a class on water in Buddhism, where I do a lot of experiential learning kinds of assignments in my classes. And that class was going to be, I actually applied for some grants to get some money to do this because I was going to take students into the water, like swimming or paddling, or because I also teach near Lake Ontario. Mm-hmm. And then also I wanted to get them to do tours of the water treatment plants. And exactly as you're saying, to really immerse yourself in the water, your body, have the bodily experience of being in water, but then also to be thinking every day, where does the water go when I flush the toilet, or where does it come from when I turn on the tap? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted them to spend the semester immersing themselves in the experience of water, which we all are, we are doing this all the time anyway, but to foreground that experience in order to, precisely as you've articulated so nicely, to transform their action to water, right? So I think there's a lot you could do. I mean, sitting by the water is the first step, but there's a lot more that we could do teaching like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you've given me a lot of great language for what I was thinking of trying to do.
Yeah, and this Buddhist experiential approach to ethics, this moral phenomenology, allows us to maybe make better sense of how these experiences translate to ethical action. Like if we look at the literature on environmental activists, for example, it's like profound experiences with like a grove of trees that gets turned into a parking lot that often catalyzes this person's now move towards environmental activism. It's this really relatedness or being within the world that affects people's change, that allows them to adopt these ethical perspectives. And I think, yeah, this experiential approach to ethics that Buddhism holds, not uniquely, but at least is within the tradition, can definitely allow us to make sense of why something like surfing could translate to conservation or what have you.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And of course, it doesn't translate in that way for many people.
For many, yeah.
and yet it can. And I think to make it a topic of exploration in a university classroom, then really it's aided by the kind of sophisticated philosophical framework that you describe in your work. So your work is a really rich way of justifying or explaining why experiential learning in the classroom is so valuable.
Yeah, and I wonder on this idea of not for everybody, Buddhism can almost maybe offer something there too, where Shabkar, who I mentioned earlier, when he adopted a vegetarian position, it was because he saw a bunch of bodies of sheep outside of a slaughterhouse outside of Lhasa. But before that, he was in front of the Jowo Rinpoche, this big statue of Shakyamuni Buddha in Lhasa, praying and meditating on loving kindness. And all of those years of meditating on loving kindness eventually made him have this shift, whereas probably dozens and dozens of other people walked by that same scene and didn't adopt that position. So it's almost this like Buddhist development of loving kindness and compassion eventually culminate in this perceptual shift that all of a sudden happens, but has this whole history of working up to that point. So I wonder if even loving kindness meditation could be included in a course like that to eventually affect these kind of profound experiences in students.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so interesting. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I wonder if you want to say something about where your work is going next, that's something that I haven't asked you about.
Right now, I'm working on a monograph for the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics series with Palgrave Macmillan. What I'm trying to do is articulate this entire Buddhist approach to animal ethics as we understand animal ethics in the Western philosophical tradition today, and then look at the practical implications of that in terms of how we eat, in terms of scientific methods, in terms of even environmental ethics, and whether or not there's relationships between animal ethics and environmental ethics in a way that's often not as obvious as maybe most assume. So that's what I'm working on now, and I'm just going to continue pursuing this kind of creative approach to trying to take Buddhist philosophical and contemplative materials and apply them to these pressing issues that we face today with respect to the environment and non-human animals. So hopefully I'll be able to do this for a while more.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. I'm so excited to read that book when it's ready. And I really have loved exploring all of your work. And it's been so great to talk to you about it more.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. And thank you for having me.
This episode of Buddhist Studies Footnotes was created, produced, and edited by me, Frances Garrett, with support from the Robert H. N. Ho Family Foundation Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Toronto. This project aims to make Buddhist studies research freely available to students and the public.